It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk about why blood donations are way down this summer and the nation's looming blood shortage.
First, we take a look at the state of international peace and the economic impact it can have. According to a new report from the Institute for Economics and Peace, the number of wars around the world is declining, but at the same time, the world has become less peaceful.
The Institute was able to put a price tag on all that violence and found that in the last year, it cost the global economy about $1,300 per person last year. That adds up to nearly $10 trillion overall. All of this raises some interesting questions. How can both the amount of wars and the amount of peace be decreasing at the same time is one of them. And how do we measure the cost of peace, which isn't quite as concrete as measuring the cost of war?
Joining us now to talk about these questions is Talia Haggerty. She's a peace economics consultant, and she writes about peace economics on her blog, Theory of Change. She joins us from Argo Studios in New York. Talia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how do we measure international peace?
Well, there are two different kinds of peace, and so there are two different ways to measure peace. I'll tell you about the two methodologies that the Institute for Economics and Peace uses, and we'll keep in mind that these are kinds of new things, so we might still come up with even better ways to measure peace. But the first kind of peace that's important is called negative peace, and that's just the absence of violence. We also have something called positive peace, which recognizes the idea that at some point we might put our guns down, but that doesn't mean that the reason we were fighting has gone away. Positive peace represents a state in which we don't need to turn to violence to solve our problems. So the Institute for Economics and Peace, who I've done some work with, they publish something every year called the Global Peace Index, which is an econometric index that uses 22 indicators to measure the absence of violence, or what we call negative peace. Then they have another tool called the Pillars of Peace, which measure the different kinds of social structures and institutions and good things about our society that coincide with the absence of violence and make up this idea of positive peace.
And as we mentioned in the setup there, war, at least war between different nations, seems to be on the way down. I think you used the phrase 20th century problem, international warfare. Where are we seeing an increase in violence around the world?
Yeah, that's correct. So what we typically define as war in the academic world, in the peace economics community, is a pretty high level of fatalities, and it involves organized parties, one of which is a state, fighting against each other for stated goals. That kind of organized violence is on the decline. We're seeing fewer and fewer wars around the world, which is a great thing, and that means that the problem that plagued us in the 20th century, we've come closer to solving. But at the same time, we're also seeing a lot more of what I call decentralized breakdowns in peacefulness. Those are things like terrorism, like violence against women, like the drug wars, where, for example, in Mexico, there are at least seven different drug trafficking organizations fighting against each other, fighting against the self-defense forces that have come up in southern Mexico. And they're also fighting against the government of Mexico and sometimes the government of the United States. And so that's not an organized war like we typically think of war. That's more of a decentralized breakdown in peacefulness. And that's the kind of thing that's unfortunately on the rise right now.
And getting into the economics of peace for a bit, and we've heard over the years about the economics of war, not hard to think of industries that might benefit from supplying munitions, uniforms, instruments of war, that sort of thing. But are we able to measure the economic benefits of peace and what we lose in the economy from violence?
Yeah, we're getting closer to doing that. It's difficult because we have to understand peace, and peace is a really complex thing. There are a lot of different parts of it, and we still don't always know what leads a society to use violence or not to use violence. But one of the methodologies that I worked on with the Institute for Economics and Peace is something called violence containment. And violence containment refers to all of our economic activity that goes toward creating, as well as addressing and defending ourselves from violence. And so IEP's most recent work estimates that the multiplier effect of violence containment, of reallocating our violence containment spending, would be about 2 to 1. So, for example, when we're spending nearly $10 trillion in the global economy, or about 11% of our global economic activity, on either making violence or containing violence, we really could be getting $20 trillion in a peace dividend if we were to reallocate that spending. So we have determined that the myth that war is good for the economy, that's been pretty well debunked. And we actually know that we're missing out on a lot of economic growth whenever we devote financial resources toward violence.
Well, thinking about investment in a place, whether you're talking about a high-crime urban neighborhood here in the United States, or opening a business in Syria, or in a drug war zone in Mexico, that's obviously a huge disincentive for anybody, an outside corporation or locals, to want to start building infrastructure, putting money into a business, doing things that plan for the future with such an uncertain state of affairs.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And we know that a sound business environment is one of the correlates of positive peace. So we know that where there's a sound business environment and also an equitable distribution of resources, high levels of human capital, so that refers to education and healthcare and these things, that we have much less violence and much more robust structures to build and maintain peace. And so one thing that I'm hoping the field of peace economics is going to figure out very soon is how, for example, businesses can go into those kinds of places and make an investment that reduces violence and creates an economic return, so that we can be simultaneously building that business environment and making it a safer place to do business.
And nailing down that point some more, that you mentioned, you used the phrase positive peace there. Peace isn't, as you said earlier, just the absence of war. It isn't just a ceasefire. How important is it to try to make those longer-term structures that preserve peace, as opposed to just stopping the shooting or whatever the violence is for the time being?
It's extremely important. Statistically, when a violent conflict ends in a ceasefire or a negotiated settlement, as opposed to one side of the conflict clearly winning, when it ends in a ceasefire or a peace agreement, the likelihood of returning to violence within 5 years' time is very, very high. And so what that tells us is that creating that state of negative peace, just putting down our guns, really isn't enough, because people are still not satisfied.
And looking at the rise in non-international war, so the conflicts, a civil war, drug wars within a country, all those things you mentioned earlier, those, as you mentioned, are on the rise. Is this random happenstance, or a bunch of places coincidentally going through a hard time now? Or is there some underlying factor that we can point to that makes these things happen on different parts of the globe?
Well, the value of the positive peace and the pillars of peace framework is that we're starting to understand what those structures are. So, no, I don't think that violence is random. I think that violence is usually corresponding to a pattern we just haven't figured out yet. But we are starting to understand the structures that make those things more likely to occur. And that brings us back to the importance of long-term investments in peace building, and not just relying on convincing people to put down their guns for the moment. So, for example, the relationship between economic growth and income and violence has been hotly debated in the field. But what we're starting to learn is that overall, when the opportunity to do business is constrained, when resources are not distributed equitably throughout society, and when there is a lack in information, in the free flow of information, when people cannot get connected to the internet, when journalists can't do their jobs, we see that these kinds of internal conflicts are much more likely to take place.
We're talking with Talia Haggerty about the economics of international peace and how much peacelessness can cost us all over the world. We're talking with peace economics consultant Talia Haggerty about the cost that peacelessness, violence, is having on the global economy, what can be done about it, and this fairly new field of peace economics. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see a peace-driven economic approach in the United States, around the world? What do you think that would look like? What would have to change? What challenges stand in the way as you see it? 800-642-1234. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page. Talia, it seems like this is a pretty new field. You're kind of blazing a lot of new trails here, figuring out the vocabulary and the basic research at this point.
You could say that, definitely. I, of course, am standing on the shoulders of giants. There are some very, very smart people who started working on this long before I did. But the idea of referring to yourself as a peace economist is pretty new. Economists have studied war and conflict for a long time, and recently the field of peace studies has influenced us to see that if we study war and conflict, we'll know a lot about how to have war and conflict. And so we need to start studying peace if we want to know how to build peace.
And I, you know, we're on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, and I there were some who thought before then such a war wouldn't break out because of all the international ties of commerce between countries. Maybe they had it backwards. They put the economics first and the peace second. Should we be looking at the conditions for peace first and then figuring out the economic fruits of that as the secondary part?
Well, it is a cycle. So I don't think we can always talk about what to do first and what to do second, but we can talk about how we are allocating our existing resources and if we're spending a lot of money on. So, for example, we have this current situation with these young people coming to our country from Central America asking for help, and President Obama has requested $3.5 billion from Congress to deal with the situation on our border. Apparently, he intends to spend $40 million of those dollars on drones on the border. So I talked earlier about the potential multiplier effect of violence containment spending. The multiplier effect is an economic idea that when we spend $1, we get more than $1 in economic activity. And the interesting thing about violence containment spending, things like drones, things like weapons systems, even things like security cameras, is that those are unproductive investments. So when we make security cameras, those cameras aren't really used to make anything else, and we are robbing ourselves of some of that multiplier effect. So when we spend $40 million on drones on the border, we're missing out on a second $40 million of a multiplier effect that we could get if we were making more productive investments, like in education, in other structures that are going to have a payoff for a long, long time into the future. And so spending money on border security, militarizing our borders, might be not only wasted economic resources in terms of the multiplier effect, but that might also not reduce the amount of violence we have to contend with in the future. And so that could be very counterproductive.
Go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Peter is on the line in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm thinking about the way that different people from different parts of the world look at things very differently, and they have conflicting goals. And if we just look at things as if everybody has the same perspective, we may not achieve peace.
All right, Peter, thanks for the call. Talia, does this view sort of an overarching general look at the economic benefits of peace and some of the basics for a peaceful society overlook those complicated issues that arise, among other things, between people of different worldviews?
Well, we hope not, because I do want to stress that as a scholar of peace building, I don't think that changing the economy is the only answer. And so things like conflict resolution and mediation and conflict transformation and other practices that address maybe the religious tensions in a conflict or the social justice aspects. Those are really important and should certainly not be sidelined by economic considerations, because that's some part of how we've gotten into some of the messes we have to deal with today. But hopefully the field of economics, it's already very international. I work with a lot of folks across the world from many different countries and perspectives. And as a community of the peace economics community, hopefully we'll continue to integrate more and more voices into our work. So we will get peace economics perspectives from people who come from places where complicated internal conflicts are happening, and they can tell us how they look at the economy and what the economics of peace means for them.
So peace economics, you're not pushing it as a solution to all the conflicts of the world, but maybe something that incentivizes people who are trying to solve these problems to put more money into the peace side of the equation than the war side of the equation, it sounds like.
Exactly. And we're trying to help people see that mathematically, peace is profitable. And it's also possible. We know we are using econometric methods to understand the way that peace and conflict manifest themselves. And for example, one of the really exciting findings of the last few years is that nonviolent social movements are twice as effective as violent social movements. That's a statistical finding, a quantitative finding that tells us that many of us believe that nonviolence doesn't work, that it's not competitive with violence. And actually, that's completely the opposite is true. Violent social movements have about a 1 in 4 chance of being successful, and nonviolent movements have about a 1 in 2 chance.
And do you hope that just having that research and making it more publicly available will inform activists of the future when they're choosing that path of violence or nonviolence?
Absolutely. We have put a lot of global dollars and mind power into figuring out how to win wars, but we have not put a comparable amount of energy and resources in figuring out how to build peace. And so, like you said, activists can choose their tactics and their strategies. And one of my personal goals is to make more information about nonviolent tactic and strategies available to folks who might be considering that choice in their own conflicts. And we also want, you know, there are a number of outlets that are springing up with this realization that peace is both possible and profitable. The Institute for Economics and Peace hopes that the Global Peace Index will inspire governments to action when we see, for example, that the United States is ranked 99 out of 162 in global peacefulness. That's not very impressive for a global power. We have some work to do. So that's one outlet. And then on a more micro token, Foreign Policy magazine on their website, they have a peace channel that talks about the technology of peace, how we go about making peace and what we're learning about peace all over the world. So there is a growing movement around this idea that peace is an option if we want it.
So, you know, in a way, it seems new and revolutionary. And in another way, it seems like, why haven't we been working at it this way for, I don't know, a century or even a couple millennia?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Turns out that peace is really hard to measure. And the reason that the Global Peace Index, for example, only includes 162 countries when there are approximately 200 around the world is because we don't have data for the kinds of things that we need to measure in every country in order to have comparable scores for peacefulness. So we're getting better at it because we have more data and more technology to put behind the effort.
Talia, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for being interested in talking about peace.
That's Talia Haggerty. She is a peace economics consultant. By the way, she writes about the topic of peace economics over at her blog. You can check it out. It's called The Theory of Change. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress is in the home stretch, and USA Today's Paul Singer will tell us what might pass and what will probably fail by the end of the session this week.
First, the nation is facing a looming blood shortage. That's according to the American Red Cross, which says donations of blood are urgently needed and needed now.
Summer tends to be a slow season for blood donation, but it's even slower than usual this year. Over the past 11 weeks, blood donations are down about 8% nationwide. That's about 80,000 fewer donations than the Red Cross expected.
Here to talk with us about this looming shortage and to nudge potential donors is Ben Corey, External Communications Manager at the American Red Cross. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So as we mentioned, summer is a slower time usually for blood donations. What is it about this summer that seems to be slowing things down even more?
Yeah, you know, blood donations do tend to decline in the summer months for a couple reasons. You know, as people are busy with summer activities, they're busy around summer holidays, they're taking vacations, they tend to make less time in their schedules to give. And also because we host a lot of blood drives at schools, in fact, a lot, up to 20% of blood donations through the Red Cross come from high schools and colleges, donations at those types of blood drives drop by more than 80% during the summer months. Certainly this summer is no different from previous summers where donations have declined for those reasons.
But more so this summer, or are we at a typical shortage?
You know, the blood supply is not as low as it was last year. However, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, you know, donations have declined about 8% over the last 11 weeks, resulting in about 80,000 fewer donations than expected across the country. You know, we're trying to prevent an emergency situation by encouraging all eligible donors to come out and give.
What happens if we were at that emergency situation? Do you start having to, I guess, ration where blood goes and is used?
Right. You know, that potentially could mean that we're not able to supply the blood products to our hospital partners. And we would obviously have to start judiciously using blood products as needed. And obviously, we're trying to prevent that situation by encouraging donors to come out and give.
And are certain blood types needed more than others?
All blood types are needed, but especially types O negative, B negative, and A negative blood. O negative is really important because it's the universal blood type, which means it could potentially be transfused to any patient if needed. You'll see that it's used in emergency situations if a patient is rushed into a hospital and there's not a lot of time to cross-match their blood type, but yet they need a transfusion quickly. It's good to have an ample supply of type O negative on hand so they can just give them that.
Is it possible to build up a blood surplus in anticipation of like a slower summer?
You know, we always encourage eligible donors, our donors who are established with the Red Cross and perhaps donors who have not given with the Red Cross in the past, to give during the summer months in order to help prevent a situation like this. And we certainly do have a lot of dedicated donors who come in and donate. As I mentioned, the blood supply is not as low as it was last year, and that's thanks to our generous donors. But again, you know, as people become busy with the summer and schools are out of session, those donations still do tend to decline.
So give us a little blood 101. After we donate it, from our perspective as donors, it just kind of disappears. Where does it all go?
Right. So donated blood product will be tested for infectious diseases. And then assuming that's cleared, it can be separated into blood components. Now, when someone comes in and donates, they're donating a pint of what's called whole blood. Now, that whole blood can be broken up into three different separate transfusible components, red blood cells, platelets, and plasma. Red blood cells can be used, for example, for accident victims, for surgery patients, platelets for cancer patients, and plasma for burn victims, for example. So you always hear from the Red Cross, you know, when someone comes in and donates one pint of blood, they're potentially helping to save up to three lives because of those three different components.
And I know you take separate plasma and platelet donations. How are you doing on those?
As part of the urgent call, we are asking platelet donors to come in and give as well.
So how do we do in Wisconsin when it comes to donating blood? Are we pretty generous?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, this is an urgent call nationally, but donations in Wisconsin, for the most part, have kept pace with expectations. But it's important to remember that the Red Cross is a national system. So that means blood donated in Wisconsin, let's say, could potentially be given to a patient somewhere across the country if needed. So while local needs are certainly met first in Wisconsin and other places, donated blood through the Red Cross can potentially be given to folks across the country as well.
I know you're getting some media coverage, including from us. How else do you reach out and try to raise awareness of the need for blood, especially during these slower summer months?
You know, a big tool is social media. You know, I mentioned before about, you know, schools being out of session and donations decline among students. And obviously a lot of students, a lot of young people are very active on Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms. So you see the Red Cross here in the Midwest and all across the country actually very active on Twitter, interacting with eligible donors on Facebook and Twitter and various other formats and providing them with information, you know, links to particular blood drives in their areas, some information about the blood donation process and various other things. And we find it very helpful. And it also enables us to give that information to donors, and they could pass it on to the people they follow on social media as well.
We had a call from a listener, Sophie in Waukesha. She wanted to know if after she donates her blood, the blood is sold to hospitals, or does it go to them for free? How does that work?
Sure. Like other nonprofits, we are a cost recovery model. So the fee paid by hospitals covers all the costs associated with collecting the blood, testing the blood, and processing the blood, and obviously distributing it to our hospital partners. So like other nonprofits, we are a cost recovery model.
Now, if someone's never given before, thinking, oh, this sounds like a nice idea, but a bit scary, walk them through that first ever donation they might make.
You know, most donors find the process pretty simple and relatively painless. When someone comes into a blood drive or a Red Cross blood donation center, what they'll do is they'll check in, they'll read an informational booklet, and then they can proceed to the health history. In health history, we check your iron level, your temperature, and your blood pressure, and we ask you a few questions about your health history, mostly just to make sure that you're healthy enough to give. And then once you're out of that, you go to the actual donation. Now, the actual donation, the part where you're sitting on the donor bed giving, only takes about 10 minutes. So you're only on that bed giving for about 10 minutes. And then after that, you can stick around. We recommend you stick around for about 15 minutes to enjoy some free snacks. So from the time you enter a blood drive, from the time you leave, only takes about an hour. And as I mentioned before, that 1 hour is potentially really powerful because one donation can help save up to 3 lives.
One thing I was wondering, I know a lot of people can't donate for a lot of reasons. If they've lived in a certain place for a while, a disease history, that sort of thing. Does the Red Cross need non-donor volunteers?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, volunteers are really the core of the organization. If somebody is ineligible to donate for some reason, they can visit redcrossblood.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS to learn more about volunteering or other ways they can participate.
And then I gather that the Red Cross often gets an upsurge of donations after a disaster, which I know you're grateful for. Do you want to make a pitch for making that preemptive donation and not waiting for the disaster to strike?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the need for blood is constant. Every 2 seconds, someone in America needs a life-saving blood transfusion. In fact, the Red Cross needs to collect 15,000 pints of blood each day. So regardless of the season, regardless if there's a disaster or not, we constantly need a steady stream of donors year-round all across the country.
All right. And do things usually pick back up in the fall after the slower summer months?
They do. In the spring and fall months, things tend to get back to normal as people fall into their regular schedules.
All right, Ben. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Ben Corey. He's External Communications Manager at the American Red Cross. Congress is only in business for a few more days with some big issues still unresolved, including highway funding, borders, and VA hospitals.
Paul Singer joins us now for a rundown on the race to the finish. He's the politics and Congress editor at USA Today, and he joins us each week at this time for the latest from the legislative branch. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks. Nice to be with you again.
So before we dig into the specific issues here, is there a sense that you're getting that Congress has the pedal to the metal, they're trying to get stuff done?
No. there is a sense that they would like to get the heck out of here Thursday afternoon and hopefully forget about everything else if they can. There are a couple of issues they really are trying to resolve, but, you know, I'm not particularly enthusiastic.
More like high school kids before summer vacation or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Like, do you want to get your finals done? No, but if, you know, you have to.
And yet there is some important stuff on the table right now. Let's look first at the veterans' health care reform that looks pretty promising. How is that standing right now?
That's the one where they've really made some progress. Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, he's independent but parties with the Democrats, and Jeff Miller, the Republican from the House, the chairman of the Veterans Committee in the House, they basically fought it out over the weekend, and they argued and they yelled at each other, and then they agreed, and then they huffed and they puffed, and then they came up with a deal, which is pretty much the way it's supposed to work. And it looks like a deal that can probably get some support. It's a chunk of money for the veterans. It's about $10 billion. To allow veterans to go seek care outside the VA, the Veterans Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs, if they're not getting treatment and they're stuck on a waiting list. And then, you know, part of the compromise is, well, they'll have to take some of that money out of current veterans programs and out of the current budget for the VA. So, you know, again, that makes nobody happy entirely, but that's a compromise, we call it, the old school compromise. And I think it's got a pretty good chance of passing because everybody wants to do something on veterans issues. Now, I can't swear they're going to get it done in the next 3 days before they leave. It may end up hanging off until after they get back from recess.
But of everything on the table, is this a thing that you look at and you say, this, if anything gets a green light, it's going to be this?
I think so, yeah. I would, if we'd had this conversation yesterday at this time, I would have said the highway bill was the other one that was going to go smoothly. And then last night, and again, this is a deal to extend the highway bill, the highway trust fund, through May of next year, sort of a temporary patch while they work out a longer deal. The thing is, last night in the Senate, they, for reasons that escaped me, decided to tinker with the bill and change the deadline. So they'd only extend it through December in the Senate bill. So now they have to go back and argue with the House whether it would be December or May. Once again, that slows everything down. They need to get this thing done before they go away because people stop spending money on road construction when the trust fund runs out in August. So I would have told you yesterday this was the one that was going to go first. Now I'm just not so sure.
Now, the trust fund has been in trouble for a little while. What is it that you think is most pressing here when we look at this trust fund?
Well, you know, the problem is, and it's your fault, that is, you know, all of us, it's our fault, because we are getting more gas efficiency out of our cars. And when you drive a fuel-efficient vehicle, you cheat the gas trust fund, sorry, the highway trust fund, because the highway trust fund is funded with a gas tax. So if you drive 55 miles per gallon in your Prius, you are cheating the highway trust fund out of the gas tax it's supposed to have.
And bumping the gas tax, probably not going to happen.
Right. Well, you know, Congress hates raising taxes. So that's the problem. I mean, the fundamental problem is the way this thing is funded is with a tax that can't be raised while fuel efficiency increases. We're using less gas per mile. By definition, it's a mathematical problem. We're not going to have as much money to fund the construction we need.
And this is bad for a number of reasons, right? We've got infrastructure in states of disrepair, and also it supposedly fuels the economy, not just cars. You know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every year we have these conversations about the price of gas, and if the price of gas is going up or down, people are driving less. If people are driving less, or in this case, if they're driving less because they can't get on the roads, or the roads are closed, or the roads are broken down, or the bridge collapsed, it stops economic activity. I mean, the roads are the lifeblood of our economy. That's where everybody goes to shop. They drive there.
All right, so some tinkering being done on the highway trust fund, so we don't really know what's going to happen with that.
Right.
And looking at another issue that we've been tracking, the border crisis, we've been talking about this with you, in fact, over the last several weeks. So what is the response from Congress, Ben, and where do things stand today?
Well, things stand today in a really ugly mess. Again, part of the problem here is, one, the government needs money to address the fact that all these kids are sort of stuck at the border and have been scooped up and are in detention, essentially, at various places while we figure out what to do with them. The second problem is a philosophical issue, which is this. Should we change the existing law to make it easier to deport back to their home countries kids from Central America. The Obama administration initially said this is what they wanted to do. The Republicans immediately agreed. The Democrats balked and have backed away from it, saying it's unfair to these kids. And that's where we're stuck now. The Senate passed a bill that basically didn't talk about this issue at all. All it was funding for these agencies to deal with the kids who are here. The House is in the process of producing a bill that is basically just the opposite. It addresses the immigration issue of sending the kids back more quickly, and it has a very, very small funding level to help process the kids. So we are now at the point where we have two chambers of Congress taking directly divergent approaches to this problem. I don't see any way they finish this by tomorrow night.
Now, the issue you're talking about, the 2008 deportation bill, I understand that was something that was supported by the Bush administration. Do you have any background there about why it's changed shape so much over the course of those years?
Well, it's a fairly, I mean, if you think about it, it makes some sense. The way that law was written, they basically said, if you are an immigrant kid caught coming across the border from Canada or Mexico, the border guards can basically just toss you back into your country. They can make a very quick decision that you are not a genuine asylum seeker and you should be simply returned without a whole lot of process, without a whole lot of no hearing, no judge, no nothing. Other Central American nations were not treated the same. Those kids, if they arrive, they're supposed to go before an immigration judge. There's supposed to be a hearing process and all this stuff, and it takes longer. The whole idea here is to simply extend that barrier and say, well, not just Mexican kids, but other Central American kids, the border authorities can basically instantly decide they should just be put back on a plane and sent back. That's what the philosophical argument is. And that is what is now being the Democrats. Like I said, the White House initially thought that was a good idea, but immigration advocates and Democrats have been outraged by it and say that it's not fair to these kids. You could be returning them to a crisis situation, and it's bad.
All right, so obviously some big talking has to happen on both sides before we get anywhere on that.
Correct.
Is anything, do you think, going to happen by Friday there?
Nope. I doubt it.
And let's look at another issue that's been out there, the issue of impeachment and...
Yeah, that's a joke. That's a fundraising tactic for both sides. No one's going to impeach Obama. Impeachment would have to start in the House, and the Speaker of the House has said he's not going to do it. So it's not going to happen. But if you are on the sort of far conservative end of the political spectrum, you like to send out fundraising appeals saying, this president is terrible and we have to impeach him, send me $100. And if you're on the Democrat or liberal side of the political spectrum, you'd like to send out emails saying, this president is in trouble, the crazy Republicans want to impeach him, send me $100. So it's just a fundraising ploy on both sides.
Right, and John Boehner has said as much. On the other hand, he said what we are looking at is not so much impeachment, but we're looking at this issue between the legislative and the executive branch and trying to figure out where the balance of power lies in the courts, and that is going to happen, it sounds like.
Yeah, probably. I mean, they're going to file suit against the president for unilaterally delaying the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare law.
How big a deal is that?
I don't know. It's odd because obviously the Republicans wanted that mandate delayed. Their argument is that Obama is not implementing the laws the way they were passed, and this is sort of a stalking horse for that argument. I honestly am not enough of a legal scholar to know whether they have any leg to stand on. There was a hearing where there was an argument made that they do have a legal leg to stand on, but the person who was making that argument had previously written the opposite. So I don't know. You'd have to get a lawyer who knows better than I do, but it's certainly not going to be anytime soon that this is resolved.
All right. One thing we do know, there have been farewells to Eric Cantor this week in the form, I guess, of a montage-y style video highlighting some of the greatest hits of his career. What has that been like? Has it been emotional?
No, somebody. Well, it's been emotional for the Republicans in the House caucus because, again, you know, you forget the fact that these guys, guys and gals, in Congress work together, work close together, get to know each other, and care about each other in some way. And then, you know, Cantor was a stunning defeat. Was considered someone most likely to be the next Speaker of the House, and now is basically going to fade into obscurity. And you know, you have to, on a personal level, feel bad for the guy, and certainly his colleagues feel bad for him. So they put out this video that was kind of his greatest hits of his career video, and one of my pals was joking that they ought to be playing the sort of NFL Films theme song behind it, you know.
And we're going to leave it there, Paul. Thank you for joining us. That was Paul Singer, Congressman, Politics Editor at USA Today.